Wavelengths, APAP Music World Pre-Conference, APAP NYC 2018, and Global Fest. For more information, janartsnyc.org. That's janartsnyc.org.
Little girl, why are you so sad? It's almost time for Christmas.
My family doesn't celebrate Christmas.
Oh, Jewish?
Uh-uh.
Muslim?
Uh-uh.
Buddhist?
Nope. My family doesn't practice any religion, and we don't believe in things that are supernatural.
But haven't they heard? There are many ways to enjoy and celebrate Christmas that are completely naturalistic.
Really?
Really! And this Christmas, they can learn all about having a perfectly wonderful, naturalistic Christmas on Equal Time for Free Thoughts Naturalistic Christmas Special.
Naturalistic Christmas Special?
That's right!
When?
From 3 to 5 on Christmas Day.
3 to 5 Christmas Day!
Right here on 99.5 WBAI.
You're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. My name is Bill Samuels, founder of NYPeoplesConvention.org. WBAI is New York's leader in progressive talk. Whether the issue is prison reform, education reform, the legalization of marijuana, or women's rights, the people's issues are covered on these airways. So stay tuned for the best and leading-edge progressive ideas and analysis. And remember to support independent media financially.
Let me open my mic. Oh, first I have to bring the mic over to me. It's one thing to open the mic, and it's another thing to talk into the mic. Can everybody see now I'm talking? Who is that? That's Matt from the... Okay. Yes, Matt the volunteer. Hi, exactly. Yes, that's how you will be perennially known. Anyway, I should say that people are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, and over WBAI.org, and in addition, on Facebook Live. Yes, we are everywhere, so Ubik has arrived. Let us start the music. And wolves are music. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, it's a freeform show. Although I do have some interesting recordings and stuff, including an interview with a woman who is actually a representative of science fiction from China. And there'll be a movie review right after this music. So stay tuned, and if you are on Facebook, go to my page, Jim Freund, at Facebook Live, and you can do it. Oh, that's Lily Collins from Logan's Run. Okay, anyway, stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I had an idea watching the new Disney/Pixar film Coco. I wanted to see if the level of quality of a Pixar film was at all relative to its story being some form of odyssey, being about characters being displaced by means either magical or practical, and then having to get back to home and frequently family. Pixar uses the structure a lot, and sure enough, Toy Story, Toy Story 2, Finding Nemo, Inside Out, all are odysseys, and all are excellent. Monsters, Inc. is a variation on the theme, with the protagonist helping someone else get back home. Meanwhile, A Bug's Life, Cars 2, and Brave don't hold to the structure, and are generally regarded as the lesser Pixar films, Cars 2 being considered the worst. But I have to admit, I haven't seen Monsters University or Cars 3, so I don't know if that crown has been stolen away just yet. The theory doesn't hold up in any case. Ratatouille, The Incredibles, Wall-E, and Up aren't odysseys, although some people may argue the point with the latter two, and all are great Pixar films. Finding Dory is an odyssey, and is not likely to make one's list of top 10 Pixar films. Or not mine, at least. The Mexican-themed Coco, about a young boy, Miguel, voiced engagingly by Anthony Gonzalez, so desperate to enter his village's Dia de Muertos music contest that his attempt to steal the guitar of the town's martyred hero zaps him into the land of the dead, is clearly an odyssey, and an eye-popping one at that. Anyone who was disappointed that Guillermo del Toro's The Book of Life's sojourn into the land of the dead lasted all of something like 15 minutes, will have nothing to complain about here. The Pixar artists have created a colorful, towering world, one of shadows and darkness, yet strikingly vibrant, evocative of the contrast between the acknowledgement of mortality and the celebratory embrace of the importance of remembering those who have come before that characterizes Day of the Dead festivities. As in the best Pixar films, the characters and plot beats all flow organically from the situation, rather than feeling like TV writers have layered the gags on. The characters, most especially Miguel's family, both in the tangible quote-unquote real world and the skeletal ancestors in the land of the dead, have their motivations and are sympathetic even when their goals are at odds with Miguel's. But here's the interesting thing. I went through a fair bulk of Coco going, yeah, this is good, which is fine, and also, I think, a remnant of having been burned by Book of Life. And then it changed, and a large part of that has to do with the character Miguel turns to for help guiding him through the land of the dead, Hector, voiced by Gael Garcia Bernal, who starts off in goofy sidekick mold. We first see him trying to sneak over to the land of the living, dressed as Frida Kahlo, but attains considerable gravity as the film progresses. The transition is anticipated early in a lovely scene where he goes to retrieve a guitar from a companion who is doomed to fade away because his memory is similarly fading in the world of the living, and that metamorphosis is cemented in the third act, when we learn that the comical circumstances of his death weren't comical at all, and discover the real reason he has been prevented from traveling into the world of the living for Dia de Muertos festivities. And I don't want to give away too much about that, but let me note that it's impressive how, similar to Hector's growing stature, stuff that seemed like throwaway gags at the beginning of the film gained considerable significance the more the story progresses. And now, I want to explore how characters who appear silly and dismissible in Pixar films grow in our estimation over the course of the story. Think about Buzz Lightyear's epiphany watching a commercial for himself in the original Toy Story, or sweet, sad Bing Bong in Inside Out. It doesn't always work. We do have Mater in the Cars movies to deal with. But when it does work, as it does in Coco, it's heady stuff. Which is my way of saying I was crying like a baby at the end of Coco. The film is wonderful and is worthy of standing with the likes of Inside Out and Toy Story 2 as among Pixar's best. And while I'm here, I wanted to address something that was raised a few weeks ago when Jim Freund and Matthew Kressel were enthusing over Blade Runner 2049. In the course of that discussion, a comparison was made to Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, specifically likening the deliberative use of screen time in Blade Runner to what Kubrick did with 2001. First off, let me just point out that not all analogies are created equal. Some are offered because comparing one work to another well-known work simplifies the job of illustrating whatever point you're trying to make. I try to avoid this, not really successfully, because it's too easy and out, and it's also something that's frequently done within the film industry itself when developing projects. It's like Jurassic Park meets Bring It On, that kind of stuff, and that gets me antsy. But there are also comparisons that are not deployed just for illustration's sake. And I think when Jim and Matt are invoking 2001, it comes with a suggestion that Blade Runner 2049 is at or close to the mastery of 2001 A Space Odyssey. In my review, I noted that opinions of Blade Runner will vary, and I won't deny Jim and Matt their judgments. Not that they let me do that to begin with, but their takeaways are what they are, and I respect that. But no, sorry, Blade Runner 2049 is not the next 2001. And part of that has to do with why Kubrick paced 2001 the way he did. As much as anything, 2001 is about humanity's place relative to the universe, the whole immense universe, and what happens when we're suddenly confronted with a perspective beyond our cozy, Earth-centric one. Kubrick uses a number of techniques to illustrate that theme without directly addressing it, through the use of editing, most prominently in the cut from a bone cudgel being hurled into the air to a shot of an orbiting nuclear device, through repetition that isn't really repetition, and through pacing, through suggesting the vastness of the universe by taking the screen time to show things happening at length. There's a reason for the deliberative pace, and I would suggest that Chris Nolan's Interstellar, a very intentional follow-up to 2001, does the same thing with screen time for exactly the same reasons. I don't detect that kind of motivation with how Blade Runner 2049 uses screen time. Nothing is illuminated in its use of pacing. It's a stylistic decision which is fine in and of itself, but it serves no thematic purpose. And that's a big difference. Jim and Matt talk about Blade Runner and 2001 being immersive experiences. I use the term experiential, but it pretty much comes down to the same thing. But living within the cinematic reality of 2001 brings one to a heightened awareness of humanity's place in this vast universe. Blade Runner does no such thing. Kubrick had a point. Blade Runner director Denis Villeneuve, in my humble opinion, does not. At some point, I might revisit Blade Runner 2049 and try to watch it both knowing what kind of film I'm taking on and also in light of what Jim and Matt have discussed. I might change my mind about the film, which I did think had numerous points in its favor, but some prominent flaws. But I'm on the fence about whether my opinion is going to be dramatically altered. I will reiterate my suggestion that if you're at all interested in seeing the film, you should. It's not out yet on home video, and I agree with Jim and Matt that screening in a good theater is the best way to appreciate it. But once it does get around to video, darken the room, crank up your audio, and make your judgment for yourself. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, hashtag ITMFA.
And you can just guess what the MF stands for. It does not stand as part of WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. And if you hear me hemming and hawing even more than usual, than I usually do, that is more than usual than I usually do. You see, it's talking like that, where you're just filling time with empty words. We're on Facebook Live, and I don't have a guest live in the studio. So we have people who are typing. It's sort of like listener phone calls. Instead of phoning, they are texting. They're chatting, really. It's an open chat. You are most welcome to join that. You go to Facebook. Hey, Rocky. You go to Facebook. And you can see what I'm chuckling at as people type, and you can all talk to each other, and you can talk to me when I'm a little more receptive to being able to take calls, and it's easier to screen than call-ins. Yeah, but BAI screening, we never did that. We wouldn't have taken a quarter of the phone calls that we do. Okay, so what's up for this morning? First of all, it's a free-form show. I do have materials. I do have a really interesting hour-long interview with a woman whose name would be, I believe, properly Kan Yu Wong, but at a certain point in email and in person, she said, you call me Regina. And she works for a corporation in China whose job it is they have gotten the rights to a great deal of Chinese science fiction. They own, they've got about 250 writers that they are representing, and they put that onto, and they are trying to bring that out to other media, such as the company, I can't say it properly in the Chinese, so I won't. She says it in the interview. It's Tencent. Hi, Dan. I played your review, including the whole Blade Runner thing, the person who just did that review. Okay, so since he is now watching on Facebook, I suppose I should respond. I don't have a great response. To each their own. I was not a big fan of the first Blade Runner movie. I thought that it was a very good experiential kind of series of set pieces, but I didn't think it held together well. A lot of the things that make people love that movie were, in fact, improv, like the Tears in the Rain speech, that fabulous moment that Rutger Hauer has at the end. It wasn't in the script, so don't tell me that this was the intent of Hampton Fasher, Fanchon, and the other people, and Ridley Scott, the other people that shaped that movie, because it was improv, okay? As long as it was improv, it was not premeditated. But what they did do was they created atmosphere, and they did it brilliantly, riffing off of previous science fiction cinema going all the way back, and properly so, to Metropolis. This new movie by Denis Villeneuve, if I'm probably mangling his name, and sorry about that, but that's the best I can do. Again, with a treatment by Hampton Fancher that, from what I understand, was, like the first film, largely ignored. It also does not take the attitude that the Rick Deckard character is a replicant. All of that stuff is neither here nor there. Now, this is a very long movie. It is shy of 3 hours. By the way, so is the new Star Wars film that long. And I bet people won't feel the time passing as much. But as I say, there are certain movies. I think the best example of what I would call an experiential film, and let's see if Daniel agrees with this, and you can type in, Daniel, whether you agree or not, I would say Solaris by Tarkovsky. And Solaris was a movie that Tarkovsky made in direct answer to 2001, A Space Odyssey, which, by the way, this is something I'm going to have to discuss. We've got a lot of anniversaries coming up, and we're going to have to deal with them on the air. We have the 60th anniversary of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which I will state, and I think Dan will, oh yes, Debbie the Dominatrix. She was my favorite crank caller, the person who was asking for her was. But he would occasionally ask for Lynn Samuels and other people. I wonder if there was a Debbie. I wouldn't be surprised. Tarkovsky felt that Kubrick made a very cold movie, and I think Kubrick would probably agree with that. So he went and he made what he considered a very hot movie, all about human emotion, all about warmth. And when you get to the point that our lead character, Chris, I believe his name is going from his home and driving to Moscow to go to the spaceport, to go up to the station that is around the sentient ocean on the planet that is Solaris. Didn't mean to make a cold. Sure, he meant to make a cold movie. Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of our listeners is asking, didn't Kay, meaning Kubrick, mean to make a cold movie? Yes, he did. You can't get much colder than Dr. Strangelove or Clockwork Orange. But the thing is that this annoyed Tarkovsky. And so he wanted to make a similar film and showed that science fiction involving aliens, inexplicable aliens, could be a hot emotional movie, which is one of the things that makes Solaris so great. And seeing 2001 one day and Solaris in another, I think would make for a great, great comparison. Now, does Blade Runner 2049 belong in that category? No, Dan, I agree with you. It does not. However, the intent of the director, and Villeneuve is a fine director because all I have to say is Arrival, which I think is one of the great science fiction films of this millennium. We're only 17 years into the millennium, but, you know, we can still say that. Still a chunk of time. He's a great director, and his next project, oh my God, we will see. It's been done. It's been done twice. It's called Dune. Wow. I can see I'm going to have to brush off my Frank Herbert. And Blade Runner, Joel says Blade Runner. Yeah, I agree, Rocky. 2001 Solaris are interesting bookends. That's why I mentioned that. Blade Runner is also deliberately cold. Maybe so. Maybe so. But not Blade Runner 2049. That's a very warm, very hot movie, in fact. Because you are meant to feel for Rick Deckard. You are meant to feel for the replicant and for the human boss that he's got. Hey, M. Saidi. Nice to see. We have a few BAI people in there. Yeah, well, yeah, when if you just say Blade Runner, we know you're talking about the first one. Otherwise, it's BR 2049. So, radio listeners, again, beg pardon. I'm talking to people who are texting, chatting out on Facebook. If you want to join the conversation and you are Facebook free, I won't say deprived because Facebook comes with a lot of problems, you can call in. The telephone number to do so, to call in, is, I'm going to give you another telephone number first. The other telephone number is 516-620-3602. Speaking of, has anybody seen the Russian TV movie version of Solaris? No, I'd never heard that there was one. I'm aware of the movie by Tarkovsky. I'm aware of the remake, or I should say the different vision of Solaris by Steven Soderbergh, which amazingly did not suck. Stanislaw Lem hated them both. I wasn't aware that there was a third. Made in 1968, so before Tarkovsky. Fascinating. I had no idea, and I thought that I knew a lot about it. No, I haven't seen the Orville. I loathe and despise the so-called humor Seth MacFarlane. Black Mirror, I have seen one episode and one episode only, and it was sheer genius. Absolute sheer genius. It was called A Night in San Junipero. I remember the business about San Junipero. But there's a lot in Black Mirror that I have heard about that makes me not necessarily want to see it. I don't want to be constantly hit over the head with darkness, darkness, darkness. But I do acknowledge that Charlie Brooker, who is the showrunner and primary script writer for Black Mirror, has done some genius work in science fiction television. We're in a golden age of science fiction television. It's amazing. Fargo, and yes, in the second season of Fargo, there is a flying saucer, so I dare say it qualifies. There are also some events that are perhaps supernatural or not. Legion, by the same person, Noah Hawley, is just amazing. Man in the High Castle is much better than it has any right to be. And we're about to embark on a new Doctor Who adventure in about a month. Okay, so I was giving out a phone number, 516-620-3602. That's where you call to pledge to keep this radio station on the air. This is not a minor thing. Now, I don't pitch heavily because it's very, very difficult to make money on the overnights. Very difficult in New York. It's 1:25 in the morning. But I know there are people who are listening in California. And hey, it's only 10:30 at night. You're still up and about. You can call and make a pledge. You can also go to give to WBAI.org or just plain old WBAI.org and click on donate. And be sure to mention that your favorite radio show is Hour of the Wolf. Not the Hour of the Wolf, just Hour of the Wolf. Okay, Joel says, how different is the setting of The Man in the High Castle, the show, from C.M. Kornbluth's earlier USA ruled by a victorious Axis story, Two Dooms? You know, I don't remember that story. Rick, are you still typing online? Rick is pretty much, Richard Bowes is more of an expert on Kornbluth than I. I love Kornbluth, but it has been years, I mean 40 years, since I've read him. I deserve a treat. I should reread Kornbluth. So I can't really answer that. If it is similar at all, to a C.M. Kornbluth story. I don't have a problem with that. Kornbluth is great. I wish somebody would do some Fred Pohl. I wish, it also had the USA split across the middle with Japan, with the West and Germany taking the East. Okay. Quite possible. But what Dick did with The Man in the High Castle was something, and what they are doing with, it's not an adaptation. The TV series is not an adaptation of The Man in the High Castle. It is rather its own story taking place in the universe that Dick depicted in his novel. And it takes a few characters from it as well. And this is a wise choice because most people that have tried to actually take on Philip K. Dick have totally failed in doing so. So let us, by the way, again, let me repeat the telephone number to pledge your support. One of the good things you can do is become a WBAI buddy, where you give like $10 a month for, well, let's not say the rest of your life, but for a while. So please give a phone call, area code 516-620-3602, or visit WBAI.org or give to WBAI.org. Ooh, are you all noticing that I'm not saying, yes, like Westworld, the show versus the movie, although I haven't watched Westworld. Do I think Fantastic Planet would ever be made in live action? I'm sorry to say that they might. I think anything... Today, that story is rather dated. About the fifth time I saw Fantastic Planet, I'm sorry, it did not hold up. If you would like to call on the air, by the way, telephone number is 347-335-0818. And the topics are science fiction and fantasy, adaptations and things like that. And I'm particularly interested in discussing Asian science fiction. Or we can keep on this theme and we can just all talk together as well. Hey, Robert, good to see you. I will see you in a few days, I believe. At any rate, yes, anniversaries. I mentioned that before. Okay. So usually I play the Council of Elrond, my production along with Margot Adler and Dave Marks with Baird Searles Reading the Tolkien. I usually play that approximately the week between the last main holiday of the year, which happens to be Christmas and New Year's. But Tolkien's birthday is January 3rd. So I was and I'll be on the air the night of January 3rd. So I was thinking, why not make a switch? Start doing it there. And then I saw something else. Hey, Paul. And that something else is that January 1st, 2018, is the 200th anniversary of the publication of the novel Frankenstein, or the Modern Prometheus, at the time published by an anonymous author. She wrote it in 1816, but it was published on January 1st, 1818. So if one buys the premise, and I am one of those who do, that science fiction was cobbled together in the same way as a monster, that science fiction began 200 years ago, January 1st. And as Arthur Miller would have somebody say, attention must be paid. And I don't think it's going to be a single show either. So what am I going to do? Okay, usually I do a Steel I Span show. Then I have the Council of Elrond. And in addition, now I'm going to have to do the first of what I hope will be a series of programs about Frankenstein or the birth of science fiction or Mary Shelley. But so I'm going to put that on January 3rd. And I'll do the Tolkien in its usual place, which means that I will probably do a Steel Eye Span special next week. And then that will take us through the end of the year and into the beginning of next year and into, I'm going to just say it this way, the 200th anniversary of modern science fiction. There we go. If you listeners have any idea, the year of Frankenstein, as a regular listener says, and I am, I'm quite willing to go with that. I think that we ought to have at least one show a month that relates in some manner to Frankenstein, and you know, not about the movies. We're talking about an important novel by a teenage young woman. What was she, like 16 or 17? Hanging out with the likes of Lord Byron and Percy Bysshe Shelley, and coming from the amazing mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, and later being portrayed by Elsa Lancaster. So, I need ideas to flesh out, like, you know, when I say ideas, specific texts, specific people, specific things that we can do to honor 200 years of science fiction, 200 years of Mary Shelley, 200 years of Frankenstein. The rest will all take care of itself. So, either we will take phone calls or, if you wish, chat on Facebook, and I will relate what you type. And unfortunately, see, what I'm going to do now is, you hear how froggy my throat is? I can turn down my mic, clear my throat, and the radio listeners are spared the ignoble tea, the ignobleness, the disgusting behavior of me clearing my throat. The Facebook people see it all way too close up. Yeah, the camera's right in my face. Pretty much. So, yeah, you can type in chats. You can call 347-335-0818 to chat, or, pardon me, or we can get on to that topic, that interview, which I did just a week ago. We had a terrible, sad thing happen, which is that we had this wonderful event a week ago Tuesday of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, with Sarah Pinsker playing a set of music, and then Kat Valenti, Heath Miller, why did I almost say Heath Ledger, and Sarah doing a game show. And we film these things, and people can watch the films. And the video got clobbered. It blew up due to what they call, on my favorite web show, TV show. It's actually going to be a TV show tomorrow night, but the thing to do is to watch it on YouTube. Safari Live, they say Gremlins, which goes back, of course, to World War II. So James asks, what sci-fi, I call them SF, what SF writer do I feel was or is better as a horror writer? None. Okay, Stephen King. How's that? Stephen King has written some very good science fiction, but he's a better horror writer. Is Robert Bloch better at horror? Maybe. But the two are intermingled, you know? Horror and science fiction bleed into each other. The same horror is, it's not just a genre. It's a reaction. It's a reaction that one is supposed to feel from a story. And I'm quoting Ellen Datlow here, at least paraphrasing her. So that when you can have a fantasy story that is horror, you can have a science fiction story that is horror, the same way that you can have one that is comedy or drama. You can have a science fiction story that's comedy. So is one better as comedy? No, not Lovecraft. Lovecraft was not a science fiction writer. He wrote his eldritch fiction for the pure idea of scaring the bejesus out of people. He did not like them. So Lovecraft was not a science fiction writer. There is no place for him on those particular shelves. He was a horror writer, plain as simple. So horror and science fiction and fantasy, science fiction and fantasy, well, even science fiction and fantasy can blend. Science fantasy, what is Star Wars but science fantasy? It can never happen. It's supposedly in the past, a genius move on George Lucas's part. Cleve Cartmell, don't know him, so I can't comment. But again, the point is that these things are not exclusive of each other. If somebody like Lovecraft just wants to set out to write horror, that's fine, but then he's not a science fiction writer. There are some very good science fiction stories that are also horror stories, but there are very few writers who write science fiction whose output is all science fiction horror or all fantasy horror. There is dark fantasy. That's a whole other thing. That's not necessarily horror. There is at least one person I know who feels that as a writer, they write fantasy or science fiction. And lo and behold, that person was proud to discover that they made more than one best of the year list in horror. And that person said, I don't write horror. That's not what I'm writing. Well, apparently, those people that have determined that what the best of the year's horror is gave this person an honorable mention, 3 honorable mentions in 1 year, and 2 in another, as I recall. And guess what? That person is a horror writer, but never set out to be. Never set out to be. So there. So maybe what I will do at this point, because that interview that I'm mentioning, it's unedited. It runs over an hour. And we only have an hour and 20 minutes left. Less, if you include my outro music. I don't know if Lister will be here this week or if it's Hobday Solosny. I'm delighted to see either. But let's see now. How do I get... I have my little thumb drive into the computer. I have a new way to not forget that thumb drive, which is often attached to my keys. Not attached to my keys anymore. Okay, so where is that thumb drive on this blessed computer here? It's not. It has to be up somewhere, right? It's Windows 10. I have not gotten used to Windows 10. I am strictly a Windows 7 person. Let's see. Ah, okay. There we are. Flash. Not Gordon, just it's a flash drive. Interviews, there we are. Okay. So that interview, right click, get properties, slow computer. That interview runs 1 hour and 6 minutes, probably a little less. And I can always jump start it, which means that I have to start it within 10 minutes if we are to play it. And I do believe that is going to be the agenda for this morning. We can still chat here on Facebook, but on the radio, we're going to play an interview for over an hour. I might leave you just looking. I've been trying to get to my, you have to come to the, what can I say? You usually work on Tuesdays. But we don't start till 7, and we go till 9. There ought to be time for you to show up at one of the readings. Charles Cooper, oh, good God, how are you? It's been years. I won't say co-worker, because he outranked me so much so, and we were both working for the best computer publisher at that time. Oh, you work in the evenings. Oh, well. So, the coop abides, indeed. This is good to know. Charlie Cooper is a great writer. Not of science fiction, of technical affairs. Charles, you, the coop, you may notice that a colleague of yours, Ms. Krasnoff, is also... I think she's dropped off and gone to sleep. How about X-Files? Chris Cartwright, you know what? I didn't like X-Files. Now, you know, it was okay. There were some good episodes. He wasn't so interested in whether the aliens were scientifically accurate, just scaring the pants off people every Friday night. Yeah, but it's not horror either. It's just dark science fiction. And science fiction, I'm sorry, guys, call it speculative fiction, okay? That way, you know, it means that it doesn't have to be scientifically accurate. It just doesn't. We don't care anymore about that. Hugo Gernsback's day is done. Now, there's a lot of good hard science fiction out there, and if you think about, oh, there's a future that one could admire or not admire or whatever, is fine. But it's irrelevant when it comes to Star Wars, X-Files, Star Trek. It doesn't matter. You're splitting hairs. So you want to call it horror? Fine. It's horror. Move on. What it is, it's a TV show. And a very, very inconsistent one at that. So, I'm going to... What kind of music should I play? I've done the end of the world as we know too often. But let me go back to that flash drive. And I'll choose something from there. Maybe even something from my online music library, which is vast. Oh, yeah. Definitely. Something totally irrelevant to science fiction or fantasy, just great music. Here's some Annette Henshaw.
Gonna die if sweet man should pass me. goodbye. If I die, where'll he be? He's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me. Don't know any reason why he treats me so poorly. What have I gone and done? Makes my troubles double with his worries, when surely I ain't deserving of none. Moaning low, my sweet man is gonna go. When he goes, oh Lord, see, he's the kind of man, he's the kind of woman like me. So poorly, what have I gone and done? Make my troubles double with his worries, when surely I ain't deserving of none. Moaning low, my sweet man is gonna go. When he goes, God deep, he's a man that needs a woman.
That's all. You're tuned to WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. The name is Jim Freund. We're also on Facebook Live. Just shoot every alien within eyesight with a phaser. Heading to sleep now. Have a great show. Likewise, it's great to see you, Charlie. And don't forget, you can actually watch this tomorrow or the day after or next year, if I finish this correctly. Usually these are saved. You can watch last week's show now instead of watching this one. Look at Kat Valenti rather than looking at me. Good choice. That would be a very good choice. And she read a great story. Oh, did she read a good story. Timely, too. Hey, Tom. Okay, so, as instead of just chatting to everybody on Facebook Live, but let me, Annette Henshaw, it's Henshaw, not Henshaw. Nina Paley, Sita Sings the Blues Animation, Copying is Not Theft. Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Facebook doesn't want me to see the whole comment. Let's see. People can grow body parts, can be used by others. Cordwain Smith's plant named Sheol. That is a horror story. I will say that. That really is a horror story, that Cordwain Smith story. And I was thinking about Cordwain Smith, Paul Linebarger, earlier, because we're getting into Chinese science fiction. So, I got an email from this woman saying that she was going to come to last week's event, and and that she was in town in both in Boston for SmothCon, as well. Cordwain Smith is his own genre. I'll go along with that. Okay, you know, when I start playing this interview, I'll talk to you on Facebook about Cordwain Smith. I have these dreams. I really do. Ambitions, I should say. So she tells me that she's in town. She's going to come to the reading. She's learning as much as she can about American science fiction to be sort of an ambassador between Chinese science fiction and American science fiction. She does a lot of work with Clark's World magazine along these lines. And I work with Lightspeed magazine, where we've published a number of stories of Chinese and other Asian science fiction. And this is something that is great. Another barrier that has been broken in the last couple of years. And this woman has been a part of it. So I'm sorry for the crudity of the interview. It's totally unedited. And I think people actually come over and say hi occasionally. But let it be. Join us. And you can also join us on Facebook. Okay, I double click.
We are now
here
recording.
We are.
Yeah.
And I begin. I'm very, very informal. Mm. You should know that immediately. Otherwise, I wouldn't be recording out.
Yeah, yeah.
In the open. But it is December 5th, 2017, in the afternoon in the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. And I am not going to introduce you. I'm going to ask you to say your name in English and in Chinese.
Okay. So I'm going to say my name first in Chinese because that's my official name. It's Wang Kan Yu.
Wang Kan Yu.
Yeah, Wang Kan Yu.
Kan Yu.
Okay. Yes, exactly. And in order for my Western friends to call me in an easier way, I name myself Regina in English.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a lovely name, but why did you choose that name?
Well, it's some very random reasons. When I was still a middle school student or something like that, I loved this a game character who's actually called Rani, and I wanted to have like the characters of her name in my English name, so I looked up in the dictionary and found Regina. And since Regina also has the meaning of queen, while my family name in Chinese, Wang, has the meaning of king in Chinese, so it kind of matches.
Okay, very good. So now you are obviously very bilingual. You are sort of an ambassador, is that fair to say, for science fiction and science fiction fandom and science fiction professional writers between the U.S. and China?
Not only between U.S. and China. Yeah, I guess.
Tell us who you are, what you do. So I should mention that this was like almost a chance meeting that I'm so happy about.
Yeah, me too.
I wish we had more time.
Yeah, me too.
But you're on a whirlwind tour of the U.S., or at least the East Coast.
I it's actually my second time in the U.S. I went to Boston for SmallCon in the past weekend, and then, like, I think, well, it would be great to have a side trip to New York and meet some people. And so I looked up online and tried to check what they have in New York, like some local science fiction group meetings.
That's something that we used to have a lot of that have sort of died away over the last few years. There'll be a resurgence. It's going to take a couple of years before that happens.
Yeah.
But Boston is very, very active. Mm-hmm. And SmothCon, we should explain for listeners, Smoth means secret master of fandom.
Yeah.
And so there are people that they try to behave as if they run the whole show, although they're no different than anybody else. And they call themselves Smoth, and they make it a verb that when people are conspiring to put together a convention and a Worldcon, they're Smothing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And when they want to get together, that's SmothCon.
Yeah. I think, like, people are nice there, and they talk a lot about how to run the conventions better. And there were also, actually, I thought there will only be con runners, but I also met John Scalzi there and people from CIFWA. So I think it's changing. It's not like people are just claiming themselves to be this masters, but they are really caring about the fandom and do do things to...
Well, I would say Scalzi is definitely a smurf.
Okay.
because you know, he gets people online from his blog. And when he, and as a former president of the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, he made himself big man on campus, which is another... who were the other people from SFO who were there?
Kate Baker.
I knew.
Yeah, and Steve Silver.
Okay, two great people.
Yeah.
And they are both smoffs. It's not just that if they weren't in the jobs that they have.
Yeah.
And Kate, of course, is a colleague of mine in that she does the narration and production for Clark's World.
Yeah.
And I am her evil competition. Which is to say, I work for Lightspeed magazine.
Yeah.
And Lightspeed and Clark's World are similar. And very importantly, not to the extent that Clark's World is, but we do publish some Chinese science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not just because of Charles Yu and Ken Liu and these people. It's because both editors, and particularly Neil with a passion, are going out to make sure that they are multicultural.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're doing a little more, I say we, I'm not the editor, I'm the audio editor and the host of the podcast. Like Kate. Kate doesn't run Clark's World, but she is the voice of Clark's World.
Yeah.
And I think the world of her, by the way, both as a support person and as a voice person.
Yeah, yeah. I can see that. We had Neil in China in the last months because we, like, actually the company I'm working for, Storycom, is the first behind the Clark's World translation project.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, we collaborated with Neil to make sure that we have continuous Chinese science fiction stories translated into English and published in Clark's World. And the cooperation started approximately 3 years ago.
Ah, okay, a little longer than I thought. Because I would have guessed like two and a half.
Oh.
But 3 years,
Yeah, 3 years. And
the fact that he's doing that is so brilliant, so wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Our pleasure, because where am I going to read new stuff? Where am I going? The whole point to me, I should stop talking like you talk, but to me the whole point of science fiction and fantasy is to read about new places, new cultures, new ways of thinking. And especially as an American, that can get very boxed in. So I was growing up in the late 50s and the 60s, which was a very boxed-in era of thinking. And people were not into seeking out cultural alternatives. Cultural alternatives were often frowned upon. But science fiction is different. Science fiction is for people whose minds quest.
Yeah.
And how can you quest if you're not taking in the science fiction, the fantasy, the mythology of arabesque fiction, of African, of Asian, and especially Chinese, which is so rich in story and literature, always has been. So tell me about StoryCon. What is StoryCon?
Yeah, StoryCon is actually, we call it Story Commercialization Agency. Yeah, and we adapt science fiction stories from literature into movie, TV series, games, or cartoons, or comic, or etc. We try to find what can be turned into other forms of media from those literature. You know, like, it's the same, like, the literature readers are, like, they there are not so many people interested in reading books nowadays. And so they watch movies and they play games and
I do those things.
Yeah, we too.
Yeah,
everyone does. So for those good stories, we try to figure out which of the stories written by writers are suitable for adaptations, and then we work on them and make them into other media. And also we try to promote science fiction culture, both in China and internationally. Like in China, we try to do more to break the boundary between this small science fiction fandom. We try to reach out and make more people see, oh, there is this interesting genre called science fiction and they have good stories. And outside of China, we try to do more like introduction of Chinese science fiction and show them that, okay, we have great stuff, and that's why we collaborated with Clarkswold, and just to show English readers and also readers of other language that there are good stories there.
Yeah, and that is prose. There you're not just going for the movies and games and things like that, especially with Clarkswold.
Mm-hmm.
Clarkswold is the written and spoken word.
Yeah.
That is their domain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my next... Well, first of all, when you're adapting to other media, what companies... what might we be able to see, say, on Netflix or someplace? I've been watching a few Chinese and one or two Korean things. Can't find any Japanese, but I watched a series called, When a Snail Loves a Lion, is that the name of it? It was a police procedural.
Uh-huh.
That takes place, it's in China, about a young woman, a forensic detective who's new on a team of police.
Uh-huh.
And everything is beautiful. There's no pollution where she lives.
Uh-huh.
There's no, it's very idyllic, and comes from the name of the huge, huge production company is 10%?
Tencent.
Tencent.
Yeah.
They're the producers of it. And all of a sudden, they're putting a lot of stuff that's now available on Netflix in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm gobbling it up. I can't get enough of it. Some of it is very good. Some of it, not so much.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need all the soap operas that take place in the Forbidden Palace.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of them are very badly written. But, but the scenery is gorgeous.
Yeah.
So are you working with a lot of different... I guess what I'm asking is, when I grew up,
mm-hmm.
Was still in the Mao era, of course, and the so-called Cultural Revolution boxed everything up.
Mm. Yeah,
so
exactly.
There was very little information getting in or out.
Yeah.
But today it's a very, very different atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think a company like Tencent could have existed 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
Yeah. That's more like one part is because of the thing you said. The other part is because Tencent actually started from instant messaging system.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, so it's all about internet. So 20 years ago, it's impossible.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
Yeah.
But the idea of what they do culturally.
Yeah.
But, Facebook, Google started as a search engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now they're onto flying cars and things like that. So you never know when a company starts.
Yeah. Exactly.
Where it's going to end up.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think they have so many different business lines, and those entertainment and culture thing is just one branch of it. And I think they since it's a large enough company, so they had enough resources to make those international channels to export their the series that they produced, and it's they have just a large base of resources, money, mm-hmm. and like cooperators or something like that.
Yeah. So how does your company, how does Storycom, work with a company like that? Or are you first looking for the writers and the properties?
Originally, we began about 5 years ago by cooperating, like by looking for writers and the products. And at that time, like the three-body problem has not won the Hugo yet, and science fiction was not that popular as it is today in China. So we reached out writers and to good stories and purchased the adaptation rights from them. So we had a kind of a reservoir of good stories that we are authorized to adapt into other forms. And about 2 years ago or something, when we are in possession of enough good stories, and we start to work more on like look deeply into how we can actually make them into other forms. So what we do is like the initial stage of developing stories, because there are many movie producers or TV producers who are interested in making science fiction movies or TV series, but they don't know how to do it, and they can't just take a story and make them into a script. And what we do is to provide the service of, okay, we are expert in on this, so we can actually let you know how to make that into a good script, and what direction we should go. And then later on, with the growth of company, we think, okay, we should also like have our own like in-depth project which we control, like we follow from the beginning all the way to the production. We don't do the production, but we can kind of still keep an eye on it and be one of the presenters.
So you'll be consulting on the actual production.
Yeah, exactly. But still, we like currently we are doing more projects that we have them all the way from stories into the outlines and the scripts. And so we know it will be a good story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, how do you assure? Well, okay, this is now from Chinese to Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we have a big problem in this country,
yeah,
with stuff that's written into English, into American, and sometimes mm-hmm. British production.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of science fiction is totally ruined
mm-hmm.
by very bad production values, and
yeah,
science fiction for many years in this country
mm-hmm.
was considered sort of a ghetto literature.
Mm-hmm.
Very low brow, no esteem to it. When people would say to me, because like you, I work as an advocate for science fiction,
mm-hmm.
So I'll say, you know, many of the best novels ever written are science fiction. And people say, like, name one. I'll say, 1984. And I hear back, that's not science fiction, that's literature. Well, so first there's that problem.
Yeah.
And then the next problem is the first time that 1984 was produced as something other than the novel by George Orwell, it was a 1940s, late 40s movie
mm-hmm.
or early 50s with Edmund O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not what Orwell wrote. It doesn't, it was an okay movie if you didn't know the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just an example,
yep,
of major science. And then, of course, in the 1950s,
mm-hmm.
the U.S. was, the science fiction they were producing, with the exception maybe of The Day the Earth Stood Still and Forbidden Planet,
mm-hmm.
it was junk. It was just junk. You know, the from Metropolis until maybe the day the those two movies I named, and then there wasn't anything until 2001: A Space Odyssey, 1967, and then you have to wait for Close Encounters and Star Wars another 10 years.
Yeah.
So China, I dare say, is getting a more mature start, a later start in adaptation and doing this and viewing science fiction. How do they, how do the audiences there, and more importantly, I guess, the producers, and how does Storycom help assure that what's being done is good science fiction? That's part A, and then part B gets into the international question. So that's
Okay, so to be honest, the movie industry back in China is not mature, actually. It's we can see many, many bad movies in China, and science fiction movie in China is kind of brand new. There were some like science fiction movies in the 80s, but that's like not like it is today, and we don't have a mature industry chain of making science fiction movies. Like, we have been like talking about the like kind of the beginning year of Chinese science fiction movie for many years, but it still hasn't come yet. And we to be honest, we can't make sure that we make good science fiction movies. We know it's a super hot road. What we are doing is that we try to do that. We are trying our best, and there are many, many companies into doing that, and everyone has different approaches. So what Storycom is doing is that we know there are no, like for example, directors or script writers who knows about science fiction movies, because there were none in the past 20 years or something in China, so-called science fiction movies. So we actually starts with a program called New Creator Incubator Program. So
I've heard of that.
Okay, good. So we allow some small budget movies, and which those new directors and script writers, they can use as kind of a practice and make those small budget movies, and that because that's lower risk. So we don't need to persuade some like giant company like Tencent to you give me $1 million and we make a big movie, but we start with those small things, and we choose stories. We choose stories either is in the near future or is related with Chinese people's life. So what's easier for the common audience to accept? We don't do like space opera. Well, we have some spacecraft movie, but we don't do those giant setting movies like Star Wars.
Not yet, although the technology certainly exists in China.
Yeah.
Because if you take a movie, I have to say, I was not a big fan of the movie The Wall.
Mm-hmm.
But that had to do with, the casting choices and the direction overall.
Mm-hmm.
But you take a look at that.
Yeah.
And it is gorgeous.
Yeah.
It is beautiful movie making.
Yeah.
And as I say, it's a new industry, really.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, take a look at outside of Fritz Lang,
mm-hmm.
and Germany was, you know, in the 20s producing the best movies anywhere.
Yep.
It was not Hollywood.
Yeah.
It was Germany. That's until Hitler takes over.
Yeah.
So it took the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
what, 30 years to make something even barely watchable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even then it was crude.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's not hard for China to make those movies with super fancy pictures.
Right.
Yeah, but like it's hard for us to have a good story, a good script.
Well, that's everything.
Yeah.
Because some of my favorite movies are very low budget films.
Yeah.
You know, there have been films that have been made with no more than, you know, a good camera phone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So what our approach, like there are many different approaches about this Chinese science fiction. Our approach is that focus on the story itself and make good stories. It does not need to be like that large budget from the very beginning, but we need stories to be good.
Yeah. So who at StoryCom is, do you have editors who chooses the stories?
We had a colleague who's a kind of story hunter or story purchaser, and he
in the US we would say acquisitions.
Yeah, acquisitions. Okay.
An acquisition editor, for example.
Yeah. And he's actually a science fiction writer himself. So
as are you, we should point out.
Yeah. Thank you. And he's actually also one of the authors. StoryCom has this long-term cooperation. We have some long-term cooperation with certain authors, and we kind of develop their, basically all their stories. And we have the rights of developing all their stories.
Wow.
And because many of them write serious stories, and so we can make a combination and develop them. For example, take a whole world building and make products in that world building. And my colleague who actually who's this science fiction writer who's the acquisition, yeah, he reads those stories and purchases those stories, and currently we have over 260 stories.
Mm.
And so we are kind of we are still in need of good stories, but we kind of we are not that desperate into purchasing more stories at this stage as we were like 5 years ago when we just established, because we have so many to work on now already.
Yes, excellent.
Yeah.
So, and hopefully you'll be sending these out into different media. By the way, any radio, a personal love of mine, any radio drama or audiobooks?
That would be great. We hadn't made radio drama or like audiobooks, but we had made a program, a podcast program.
Yeah.
And it's on a new platform, and it's a series of podcasts about science fiction. There are several parts. Like one part is we invite science fiction writers to introduce knowledge about science fiction to the majority, and then we invite scientists to talk about scientific knowledge in science fiction. And the third part is because we have collaboration with Clarksworld, and Clarksworld is doing this podcast, so we include those English podcasts in the program. So for the Chinese readers who are interested in listening to those Chinese,
so you're producing the Chinese stories that go on Clark's World.
We are not producing it. We are recommending them. We select them.
And then Kate reads them. Who reads them?
We read them.
That's really, I guess, what I meant.
Yeah. We read them and we write summaries of those stories, and we get them to Neil, and Neil then decide, okay, I want to see this one, that one translated.
Right.
And he reaches out to the translators and translate them into English. And also there are translators who sometimes directly recommend stories. For example, Ken, he knows, these stories will be good to translate, so he directly recommend to Neil. So it's kind of
in this country, we have to mention, I've done a number of interviews with Ken, and listeners are welcome to find them online and stuff, but we have to mention that Ken Liu is one of the most important people in the U.S. to opening eyes
Exactly.
And to being himself without intending to be an ambassador, he is that.
Yeah.
He is a gateway.
Yeah.
For so many people, myself included, that it's wonderful. What are the biggest problems in translation that you encounter? Because I'm sure that there are so many expressions I know in English, and I assume in Chinese, and more importantly, concepts that that don't necessarily come across. Well, you say that, but I also want you to meet these people who just came in.
Hi, Sarah.
That's Sarah Pinsker and Karen.
Nice to meet you.
Sarah is world fantasy.
I know. Okay. Sarah has come to China and she has stories translated into Chinese.
Oh God, these people who travel.
Hi, I'm Sarah.
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Yeah.
So I got an email here from she who I shall call Regina. Saying that she was coming tonight, and I thought, I cannot not interview this woman.
Excellent. Well, we won't stop you. We'll just settle in.
So you've had stories, Sarah Pinsker for the radio audience,
yeah.
You've had stories translated into Chinese.
A whole bunch.
Wow.
I'm not going to interrupt. I'm going to let you finish.
Okay, but you know what? At some point, and I haven't had you properly on the radio show ever.
That is true.
Okay.
But look at this nice thing where it's not in the middle of the night. If you can do that, I'm happy to be on the radio show.
We can. But
radio listeners.
Both of you are free to go to the cafe and just tell them for the night that you're on Jim's tab.
Wonderful.
And they will feed you and all that good stuff. Shake, I think, is the name of the fellow behind the bar. Shay or Shake, I'm not sure. He's new to me.
Okay.
Anyhow,
yeah.
I am and I'm not. Sorry for the interruption.
No worries. Me neither.
but Sarah is... Oh, I can't let her hear that I me say that she's one of my favorite writers.
Uh-huh.
But she's one of my favorite writers.
Oh!
Neil has published stories by her. Lightspeed has done that. And I've had her at this reading series. This will be her fourth time.
Wow.
But I've still never had her on my radio show.
Oh, your next project.
Yeah. Well, I also get to broadcast this reading series.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
we were talking about this amazing Ken.
The amazing Ken, yeah, but my question was about...
The translation.
And idioms.
Yeah.
Because Ken was telling me once about the problems of people bringing in concepts like simply God.
Mm-hmm.
That this does not easily come forth to a place which has a pantheon of gods and... A force like the Zhao, if I'm saying it correctly, and the concepts between the two cultures can be very different.
Mm-hmm.
So, what issues do you have crossing in during the translations? What are some of the issues that you have?
Yeah, I'm actually not doing translation myself, but I've heard Ken talking about that, which I believe he's talked a lot on the radio program. But I guess like what's hard to translate is it's not the like exact terms or like for example those technology terms or names. It's the culture behind.
But it's culture behind it that I was more.
Exactly. And he was talking about an example. I was having lunch with him yesterday, and I actually also did an interview with him yesterday.
Oh, very.
Yeah, he was talking about some examples, and what example did he give? Let me think about it.
I'm standing.
Sorry.
you're losing my mind. You're getting caught up in the setup for the event.
I was right. Yeah, because I just slept too last. My memory is up.
Just to explain to listeners what is going on during this interview with Kan Yu, Sarah Pinsker and Karen Osborne were just getting ready to do a sound check while we were doing the interview, which is why, by the way, I would have normally gone into the booth where Madeline Flieger runs the tech, but I wanted to leave that available for the sound check. And so you hear it all.
Exactly.
And what really are you doing here? What is your job?
My job?
Here, yeah.
Yeah, here in New York.
In the
U.S. Small phone was part of it, and also visiting New York to meet people, because I'm more like responsible for the international corporations of our company. So I'm here to meet connections, meet people, and also at SmallCon, I think I learned a lot about con running things. And here I'm also meeting you and attending this event, and to see how we can kind of build a better science fiction community in China. Like, what can we learn? Because we also have fandom there, and we have activities, and I always feel inspired by how European or American fans, they do their events, and we try to learn it, and we want to gather people who love, who share the same hobby, and that's not a directly business interest to our company, but we think it's good for the industry. Just to have a larger community. And also I'm seeing some literary agents, because you were asking about the international thing, because we also want to see our writers' books published in English, or their stories made into Hollywood movies, if possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And maybe not Hollywood movies. No, I'm a big fan of Hollywood movies. Don't let anybody be confused. Mm-hmm. And yet, I find that very often it's the small films and the relatively obscure films that are sometimes spectacular and can do the best work with, everybody, there's been, 15 to 20 Philip K. Dick movies. Mm-hmm. And the best ones produced, let's wait for the feedback, and the best ones produced are small budget.
Yeah.
That nobody has ever heard of, the movie Radio Free Albemuth, or A Scanner Darkly, directed by Richard Linklater. It's an animated film. It's got Hollywood stars, but it's an independent film. Yeah. It did not come out of a studio.
Yeah.
It came out of a director.
Yeah. Exactly. Actually, we have this. We just had a movie called The End of Lonely Island in China. It's actually a small budget director movie. And originally, the director, he's even not a professional movie director. He's ad director, and he's into science fiction, so he made that movie with a budget of 70,000 RMB, which is a little more than $1,000. He made an hour movie, and that movie is about it's quite hardcore, actually. Like, when some doomsday come, and people are dying because of the comet passing away or something.
Uh-huh.
And at that time, the protagonist, which is a female, she has to choose either to use the AI that she's developing to save a small bunch of people who's in the space, who are not affected by the comet radiation, or keeping the AI on the Earth and doing some some calculations try to save the entire human being on the earth, but which is like 0% possibility. So she has to make a choice between this and that. And that movie actually was presented by Storycom and iQIYI, and it was screened online, and we got pretty good view, like a lot of people, like pretty good clicks. Like, I don't know how you count.
Hits.
Like, okay, yeah,
hits.
Okay.
In hits. The English jargon, hits.
Yeah.
It's clicks is probably a better phrase for it. No,
okay.
Really.
Okay. Yeah,
it
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
When you think about the concept
yeah.
of what we're talking about, how is looking at something a hit? But people are using their mouse
yeah.
or their finger, and they're going to click on it.
Yeah,
so
that's what we call it in Chinese.
because it makes more sense?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
In English.
Yeah.
My father had 5 languages.
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
And he always said that his first language was German,
mm-hmm.
a German Jew. Mm. At the wrong time,
you yeah.
know, a Holocaust survivor.
Mm.
And he came to the U.S. and he learned all these languages, and he always said that English and, to a lesser extent, Russian
mm-hmm.
were the least logical languages he had ever worked with.
Yeah, probably English has so many, like, has absorbed so many other languages.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a melting
glut,
I think would be a good term. Now, the movie that you just mentioned, I mean,
yep.
it sounds really interesting.
Yep.
I would like to see it.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that will come to the U.S. with subtitles?
Yeah, it has subtitles. The movie was sent to a lot of international movie festivals before it was online, and it is subtitled, but it's not on Netflix or like major US platforms, and now it's online on this Chinese platform called iQIYI, and I can secretly send you the link.
If you would, I would be indebted to you.
Yeah, exactly. And it was also screened at WorldCon 75.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't get to WorldCons much anymore. Traveling is a luxury for me nowadays.
Yeah.
So I go to about 2 or 3 conventions a year. ReaderCon.
It's a good, very good con.
ReaderCon's wonderful.
Okay.
And the name says it all.
Yeah.
And I don't, as I say, I don't mind media,
mm-hmm.
but it's nice to find a convention
yeah.
which has at the always 2 tracks of writers reading their work at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult to choose.
Yeah.
And sometimes people performing music.
Yeah.
And Cap Clave is a very small convention in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And Washington is an amazing museum.
Wow.
Forget what else goes on there.
Uh-huh.
It has the best. New York and Washington have the best museums in the country. Arguably, some of them the best
cool.
in the world.
Cool.
Arguably.
Cool. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, if you can't get to the Louvre or to the
yeah.
British Museum.
Yeah. I know Ken and Neil, they were guests of honor of Capitol Clave.
Yes, they were.
And the
whole theme
yeah.
there was largely about translation.
Yeah. And actually, I
moderated 3 panels.
Oh, wow. Actually, I spent some time talking with Bill Longhorn.
Yes.
Yeah. And whether I can announce it, but we need to do some remote panels or talks. So the Chinese writers can join Capitol Clave remotely.
Yes.
Hopefully next year. Well, I'm pushing them to like settle the technical problems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they have very good technical people there.
Yeah.
Because there's a TV show called Fast Forward with
yeah.
Mike Zipser.
Yeah.
And they have pretty good technical
yeah.
background.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask you if there's anything we can do with radio.
Oh, that would be also possible. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because I would do a lot to try to make that happen.
Yeah, yeah. If you can like have the technical problem settled, I can. I have a bunch of candidates who can talk in English and be willing to and be glad to interview.
Can they be on Skype?
Yes.
Well, then the technical problems have just been solved.
Awesome. And several.
So you and I will collaborate on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Good.
So hopefully, this has been a fruitful trip.
Yes, it is very fruitful, I'd say.
Yeah. What would now? I know that there's a lot of American science fiction writers mm-hmm. who recently have been going to China. I didn't know that Sarah had gone there, but I know Michael Swanwick goes to China like every 2 or 3 years at least.
Yeah.
I think sometimes invited.
Yeah. He's invited. In this past November, there was this first international science fiction convention in conference in Chengdu, and Mike Swanwick and what are the other American authors? Because there were Canadian authors as well, like Robert Sawyer and Derek Quanscombe.
Right.
Yeah. And also,
to me, they're American. Okay, they're American because they're in the same continent.
They're
English-speaking American, so Canada and the U.S. There are political differences.
Yeah.
Sarah's wife has had problems. So there are political differences, but culturally, very similar.
Yeah. So they were also there were some Japanese and Korean authors. They were also invited to this conference.
Do you record these conferences?
We streamed that.
It
was streamed online.
So are these streams still available?
I think so, but I don't.
Like tonight's event will be available always.
Wow, that would be awesome.
I put all my events online. They're all on live stream, and I will be editing them and bringing them all to YouTube. They're all free.
Wow, awesome!
So
I'd love to see
we've
that.
Only been in this facility for 3 years.
Yeah.
But I'll show you how to see them. They're all available.
Wow, great! I need to like look into that whether the Chengdu conference was still available to see. But I guess at least that they were streamed, so there must be something like. Recorded
there have
somewhere.
To be. Yeah. somewhere. Once something has been on the internet, it's there forever.
Uh-huh.
Now, China, I know, has a lot of problems allowing internet access in. They don't allow Google.
Yeah.
I think they just have something just got removed. I know. Well, you don't need WhatsApp, which is a terrible, terrible program.
We have WeChat.
Right. But you, do you have Twitter?
No.
You don't have Twitter. Yeah.
We have Weibo.
Yeah.
We have Chinese substitute.
Yeah. So there are still very different cultural and political differences.
Yeah.
But these are things that, in my mind, should be ways to meet rather than obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
That would be, you know, my world goal.
Yeah.
Is to meet and learn and be friendly and be happy with anybody in the world I meet.
That's similar to me.
That's what civilization is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And if somebody has a different idea from yours, wonderful.
Yeah.
That's how you learn.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and that's why, and I can't say this too many times, that's why the opening of Chinese science fiction to the U.S.
Yeah.
And hopefully, now are there any restrictions on some of the U.S. and English written science fiction being brought into China? Have there been any political issues?
As long as it is not like it does not touch sensible issues, for example.
There's a lot of very right-wing science fiction that I don't care for here, and I think that would be even worse in China.
It's just that some issues are sensitive. For example, religion, Taiwan problem.
Right.
Some like so that are kind of sensitive, so probably if the work is kind of against China on such issues, it may have problem being introduced into Chinese. The others, I think it's okay. It's more like the editors and publishers, they are super careful about the contents they publish, instead of like some government officials like setting up some like rules this right. and that cannot be published.
Yeah. So people have to use their own sense
yeah.
as a guideline.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I think it's unlikely that there'll be too much in the way of American science fiction and fantasy dealing with Taiwan, but I noticed that in the Doctor Strange movie
uh-huh.
that came out
yeah.
A year ago,
mm-hmm.
There were issues that originally, in the comic book, the Ancient One, mm-hmm. who was a man,
mm-hmm.
From Tibet,
uh-huh.
and in the movie made a woman with a Celtic background,
mm-hmm.
because they wanted to take the Chinese audience,
yeah.
which commercially
yeah, yeah,
is
yeah.
super important.
Yeah.
A lot of movies that don't make their money in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
Recoup their losses
yeah.
by releasing their movies in China.
Yeah.
Blade Runner, for example. The yeah. new Blade Runner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
film.
Yeah, yeah.
I understand it's doing very well in China.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the movie Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets, which I loved, and I'm the only one in this country who liked that movie, but doing very well in Europe and very well in China.
Uh-huh.
So, but the political things like Taiwan and, mm-hmm. all, and probably Tibet, those are probably the most sensitive. Religion, I think, though, is going to be the biggest problem,
mm-hmm.
because I think many, many... We claim not to have church and state. It's not true.
Mm-hmm.
We have church and state in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say the wrong thing,
mm-hmm.
if you say a word against Christmas,
mm-hmm.
like I'm a Jew, I don't, which is what I'll say. Christmas, Christ, Mass, that's not me.
Mm-hmm.
And as a Jew, I'm not a religious person.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a cultural.
Yeah.
backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans are very, very religious as a body.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that you see that from afar. Fewer people see that here, although in today's, shall we say, problem-ridden issues with American politics,
mm-hmm.
it's becoming more and more evident.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in China, we don't have any national religions, like no religion is the like kind of the major religion for many people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we...
But like, there's a very, very rich, not religious, but fantasy, mythology, the Monkey King stories, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but it's kind of Taoism and...
yeah.
Yeah, but it's instead of like believing in it, people just take elements from Taoism or Buddhism
mm-hmm.
into stories. There are people who, like, for example, they go to temples and they for example, eat vegetarian and they try to behave like a Buddhism believer. But that's not that strict. It all depends on like the people themselves.
Although there were two American idiots who got themselves arrested by being at a Buddhist temple and taking down their pants.
That's silly.
That's silly, it's gross, it's stupid, and they did it in China.
And I don't think they were arrested because they did it in the temple, but because they did it in public, I guess.
Whichever, it was disrespectful.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, and
yeah.
that, to me, that's the...
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, forget the law.
Yeah.
And you're stepping on people's...
Yeah.
Things that are important to people.
Yeah.
Forget the politics.
Yeah.
You just... It's just rude.
Yeah.
But anyway...
It is.
But hopefully these are, we have a freer press. I won't say a totally free press, because there's a lot of stuff that does end up getting suppressed. It's usually by commercial means rather than political.
Mm-hmm.
You know, corporations are more likely to hide a truth than our government.
Yeah.
But our government does our share in hiding truth as well.
Yeah. I see, like, commercialism is the it is the religion.
It is.
Yeah.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
That's been true, I think, since a little before the 1920s depression in the U.S.
Yeah.
That is our highest religion.
Yeah. For example, in China, we have this giant, double 11, which is the 11th of 11. We created a festival of shopping. Like, originally, it's single day, like, It's not a big festival. It's not even a festival in America, right? Single day, like November 11th. It's just some people think, okay, one in Chinese, it's just single. And then in I can't remember how many years ago, like the super large online shopping platform in China, Taobao, they had the idea of, okay, we should have this shopping festival on that day. So now it's become super large. I can't remember the exact number, but it's amazing. It's, I think, probably even bigger than the Black Friday in America. Yeah, everyone goes shopping on like 11th of the November.
Yeah, I was reading about obviously a month ago. December now. Actually this year I made a Black Friday purchase, my first time.
Ooh.
But I did it online. You know, that's, to me, it's like shopping. I do it every day.
Yeah.
I've got my phone.
Yeah.
I've got my computer.
Yeah.
And I go to supermarkets.
Yes.
And I go to crafts fairs.
Oh.
This time of year, the holiday season, I love to see things that people make with their hands.
Oh, where can you find this?
This time of year, well, there's a Brooklyn Crafts Fair. There's one called Crafts at the Armory on Park Avenue. There should be four or five different ones going on.
I think that the conversation that took place on December 5th has more or less worn its welcome. You get the idea. And you can tell from what happened during that conversation that we will clearly be hearing more from Regina Kanyu Wong, in the future, and the science fiction writers that she can help us share with. So, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, and at the moment on Facebook Live. If you go to my page. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to look at that at home, Keith. People can get on Facebook onto my page, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and you can chat, and I can respond. If you have any questions, comments about what you just heard, you can call on the air at area code 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818. And I would also like to thank Sarah Pinsker and Karen Osborne, whose fabulous music you were hearing setting up in the background. And I'm so, so terribly sorry that... Yes, right, the Android doesn't have any polarity to reverse. It's nice, would be nice if it would. Um,
And also, yes, specifically also, as I mentioned earlier, looking for ideas or people and or things to read on the air that relate to the 200th anniversary of the novel Frankenstein, first published January 1st, 1818. Yes, another, that was William Hartnell, I believe, Keith. Okay, so I'm talking to Facebook, I'm talking to you, the listeners, and all that. Just put the battery in backwards. Yeah, that'll do it. That will do it. Anarchism? Don't know, maybe. How important is William Godwin's anarchism to the birth of science fiction? I'm not sure that it's... let's see, the first science fiction writer is the daughter of the first feminist and the first anarchist. Pertwee, probably. Yeah, probably was Pertwee. Pertwee was an anarchist? No, he's the feminist. Never mind. You can go to Facebook and see what it is I'm talking about. But yeah, we will definitely have to deal with Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's environment and what that did. But also, as I'm saying, the advent, the reality of this being the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein is therefore the first anniversary of modern science fiction. Yes, well, actually, with Elsa Lanchester, I wouldn't be surprised. Well, hello, Lester.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Long live Canada.
Long live Canada, absolutely. Because and they are Americans. They're probably better Americans than us U.S. A-E-N's? U.S.
A-E-N's,
yeah. U.S. A-holes. U.S.
150 years they've been doing it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Thrown a couple for bawdy songs for the. Yes, absolutely. There, I found a wonderful photograph online of Elsa Lanchester. Obviously, in bawdier days and all that. So, how was your trip?
Oh, it was.
It was so great to see Hobday.
I thought it would be a pleasant surprise.
Oh, well, very much so. Because I used to, you know, of course, that when I was on Saturday mornings, I followed Hobday for, a dozen years easily, probably more.
I thought the combination was amazing.
And it was always delightful. Yeah. So it was great.
That was my favorite time on WBA, listening to WBA.
Yeah. And then we had, and very interestingly, we had a caller last week who was a woman, whose name I forget now, does a show on USB, on WUSB.
Oh, really?
She called to speak to Kat Valenti, who was my guest last week. So,
when are you going to come out? You got to come to the station.
That's a good question. Ask me in the new year,
okay,
which isn't very long from now.
I could probably get after to drive us out and drive us back.
Ooh, that would be interesting. Also, I can drive.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm capable of doing that myself. So, yeah, I can't pay too much attention anymore to the Facebook thing because I, until the show's over, which is in under 60 seconds from now. So, and you know what I have to do? I have to sign out here. Okay. Don't want to do what I see other people, Max, doing, which is saying, which are people continuing being logged in when, in fact, they are
logged out.
They're done, exactly.
How's so how's Max?
He seems fine. I saw Max. I saw Sydney recently. In fact, I think Sydney is watching on Facebook Live at the moment.
Sydney.
Yeah. Yeah, hi, Sydney, from all of us. And I have to say, he looked actually pretty good. Great. Yeah, which I'm very, very pleased with. Okay, so, yeah, how the heck do I sign out of here? I wish to leave.
Try sign language.
Yes, that must be it. There it is, hidden all the way at the bottom. Log out. I am logged out of there. Okay, very good. And I got a message, by the way, about the 5 a.m. show. But I think it'll be pretty clear to you, you know, that it's, you know, the pitch show.
That it's coming on at 5 o'clock, right?
Yes.
Okay,
so let me start quietly in the background the outro music, which is really a little bit past due. There we are, Tales of Silver by Steel Ice Ban. And let me say that you've been listening to Hour of the Wolf. Again, many thanks to Kanyu for that interview, and I hope to be doing work with her in the future. And thank you all for listening. You can reach me by writing jim@ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, or find me on Facebook, obviously. And yeah, those are the two primary ways. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers once again with Lister after a wholesome vacation. Not so sure about wholesome. That would be too disappointing. So have a good morning. And don't forget, radio listeners, even though this show is over, you can go to Facebook, go to my page, and watch this show and make comments on it there. It's sort of neat how that works out. So, let's see. Ah, yes, next week, I think it's going to work out that we'll do a music spectacular. The week after that, the Council of Elrond. And the week after that, celebrating 200 years of science fiction with the publication of Frankenstein. So, have a good morning. Be good to each other, everybody, and take care.
Of cloth, that's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. shit. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They said that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag. Like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Is back from Montreal, Canada, Toronto, Canada. Yeah, that reparation check to the indigenous people keeps bouncing from left to right, from right to left. Yeah, that's why we say bird, baby bird, clap bars.
Come along with me, let's take a trip. But this time not on a slave ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama. Talking about Peru. Azania. Brixton. Belfast. And forget Korea. Beirut. And forget Haiti. Iran. Puerto Rico. Colombia, Mexico, talking about uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central, LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
Canada, where 150 years the reparations check's been bouncing from left to right, right to left. 99 Sinker right here. We're still in the fundraising mode. Do support us right here at WBAI.org. Yeah. A little bit of Canadian reggae right here at 99 Sinker. Yeah, Burn Baby Burn. An exclusive. We bust this first in the USA. Seen? This is Tootsie's guitarist with his Carl Harvey project, Canadian style, y'all.
dedicating this to Jim Freund. Thanks for sitting in for me, Jim Freund. Great show this morning. And the great Apte Selassie. Apte Selassie, more than a museum, a classic right here at 99 Cinco. Hey, Midnight Ravers, this is for you. Listen up.
Send them away. Shout out to the rhythm, don't keep sleeping. Be the new song, DJ, get vision will catch and you can't escape. So feed this name a chant and give thanks, put your hands up and dance, because dancing is rain. But they don't listen now. How we make the vision amplify when we move a crowd. Visions we